Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. The PGA Tour Policy Board held a marathon meeting on Tuesday and announced in a memo to players the news that we have all been waiting for. There is now a Tiger Woods exemption category, and there will be an alternate list for the signature events in 2025. Still elusive is that definitive agreement between the PGA Tour and the Saudi Public Investment Fund. Rex, you're as dialed in as anyone. You are on site at the Travelers Championship in Cromwell, Connecticut. Despite speculation that a deal was imminent, no deal to be announced publicly on Wednesday. What the heck's going on here?
I think we were probably close to, and I think we talked about this on Sunday, so just to circle back around, I think we were close to some sort of deal that would have just laid out the financial terms of what of the agreement's going to be between PGA Tour Enterprises and Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund. That was always going to be the easiest part of this equation. And I'm doing the inside voice because I'm inside surrounded by people in a cart barn. So I'm not quite sure what happened between last week when not only me, but a lot of people were hearing from various sources that we were close to doing a deal. And here's what the commissioner, Jay Monahan, was just in the media center and we had a chance to talk with him. And he's been perfectly clear on this, quote unquote, will not negotiate this in public. Totally get it. Like, I understand it. My question to him was, is it hard for you to understand that the public is looking at this from the outside? And they're saying, well, you had a December 31st deadline and you plowed through that. Now we're another six and a half months down the road. And it doesn't seem like we're any closer. However, as someone that's in the room, like, is it hard for you to sort of project to the public the idea that this is really, really complicated? This is really, really nuanced stuff. And that it doesn't take a lot for things to go wrong. He referenced the meeting 2 weeks ago in New York City between members of the transaction subcommittee. It includes Adam Scott, Rory McIlroy, and Tiger, and the governor of the PIF, Yasser Al-Rumayyan. And he said there was a lot of ground that was covered there. And there was a lot that they were able to come to agreement about. But there's still sticking points. And I think we can kind of address what those sticking points are, to be quite frank. But right now, it seems like they're in a position where they're continually sort of going in circles. Commissioner just said 10 o'clock. He had a meeting with the PIF just this morning and that they're doing it on a regular basis. And that yesterday was a 5+ hour policy board meeting. So it seems like we're moving in that direction. But I think it's impossible to say how close we actually are.
In the memo to players, he said they've reached consensus, the PIF and the PGA Tour, on, quote, several items, and both parties recognize there's still work to be done. I found this interesting, Rex. The goal is a shared vision for the future of professional golf that is pro-competitive. In other words, looks a lot like the PGA Tour does, where it's still, at its core, a meritocracy, while also providing players with the best global opportunities. That's the first time that I've heard that sort of language be used. And it sort of harkened back, at least for me, to what Rory McIlroy has talked about for months now, the idea of this global tour that sits above the rest of the PGA Tour. And that could be 12 to 15 events. It travels all over the globe. It's for the best players, not just from the PGA Tour, but the DP World Tour, Live Golf, however you want to form that World Tour. That's the first time I recall the commissioner of the PGA Tour sort of outlining it. What was your take on that? Because it certainly appears like that could be the direction we're headed here.
I would agree with that. I will circle back around. When I think the reference to being pro-competitive, that's being proactive on what they know is going to happen. And the commissioner was just asked about whatever happens with this agreement, it's going to be dissected by the Department of Justice. And so using a word like pro-competitive is a direct shot in that direction, trying to point out that what we're trying to create here is just not good for the players, but it's also good for the fans. It's good for the media partners. It's good for the corporate partners, because that's what the DOJ is ultimately going to decide if there is going to be some sort of deal. So I think you're a little misplaced on that one. I think that was more of just sort of an opening salvo to the Department of Justice. But the other side of it is, yes. I mean, it's not as though we can sit down and ask him and expect an answer when we say, what does your vision of the future of professional golf look like? But I can imagine a universe where there is sort of this global tour and everything else underneath it feeds up into that, much like we've talked about soccer in the UK, where it's sort of this pyramid. And at the very top of the pyramid is the Premier League, and then you have the Championship League, and I'm going to get all the other leagues underneath it wrong, so I'm not even going to try to guess what they are. But that's sort of the idea. There's also the idea that, and again, if we could shoot the commissioner full of sodium pentothal and get that honest answer out, I imagine a scenario where we continue to have two separate tours operating sort of under the same umbrella, but separately. Whereas you would have LIV Golf on one side and the PGA Tour on the other side. They find a way to make it work in the schedule, and they find a way to make it work with the personnel they have, but they continue down their path. So I think there's a bunch of different options now going forward.
Yeah, I mean, that still seems like the most likely outcome of that. That would certainly help pass muster with the Department of Justice as well. If there's two competing tours, they may be borrowing players. You could have a couple of tour teams on LIV. You could have a couple of sponsor exemptions sort of set aside for LIV players, however they want to do it. I don't think there's any way that LIV just disappears. I think that's become abundantly clear over these past couple of months. What else, Rex, did you take away from what was a 15-minute scrum with the PGA Tour commissioner? I believe that's the first time he has talked with reporters since the Players' Championship in March.
Yeah, it was. I asked him specifically about, you mentioned the two things that did get decided at last night's policy board meeting. One had to do with field sizes at the signature events, and they want 72 to be that magic number. So essentially, they've added an alternate list, which will make sure, because you've had, I think, 5 of the 8 signature events this year have not made it to 72. So what they want to do is make sure they fill out the field. That one's pretty straightforward. It's going to come from the Aon Next 10, and it's going to create an avenue for players who normally wouldn't be able to get into it. I think it's a move in the right direction. And the other one is sort of this Tiger Woods exemption, for lack of a better term. The way they wrote the regulation, ironically, if you have 80-plus PGA Tour victories that you're exempt into signature events, there's really only one person that applies to right now, and it's Tiger Woods. I do think what they're trying to do is what happened in LA earlier this year, where his event, he hosted it. Clearly, he wants to play. Clearly, the tour wants him to play, but they had to use one of the 4 sponsor exemptions they have into this event. So instead of burning one of those sponsor exemptions, getting what every tournament director wants, Tiger Woods into the field, they've carved this out. And I don't think there was any pushback whatsoever. And he kind of addressed it. Like, he talked about the idea that this is good for everyone involved, just not Tiger Woods, but good for everyone involved. That being said, I can see Tiger using this once a year in LA and not the rest of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main takeaway for me, is that it remains to be seen whether this exemption category will actually be utilized. I mean, the only regular season event that he has played since returning to competitive golf in 2022 has been the Genesis Invitational, which is hosted by his foundation. He hasn't even played the Players' Championship, the PGA Tour's flagship event. Again, I have been on record, including last Sunday, as stating that Tiger Woods needs to play more competitive golf, even if it does jeopardize his major participation. To me, that's the only way he even has a chance to seriously contend in these tournaments. It is abundantly clear that he cannot just show up and do the Hogan-esque schedule where he's just playing the major championships. The fields are too strong, too deep, and it's just, I think we have a large enough sample size to know that it's not working. Tiger has made no bones about it. He is worried that he is going to get hurt if he plays more, and that would jeopardize the majors. To me, just go all in. If you're good, if you want to actually contend the major championships, you have to play more golf. That could include, Rex, using this Tiger Woods exemption category. I'm also a fan, curious your thought as well, about this alternate list to ensure the field sizes are 72. You might as well reward the players who were just on the cutoff this week in the Travelers Championship. It's just 71 players, because Rory McIlroy withdrew. More on that in just a little bit. What's been the reaction from the players? Because I know field size and cuts in particular has been a big talking point among them.
They just started a press conference in the media center, so I'm even going to have to take it down even more than a notch. If there's anything you want me to ask Michael Thorbjørnsen, please just let me know. I'll be sure to do it. I will say this about the field sizes for the signature events. This is a move in the right direction, talking with players. I don't think it's the move that most players want. We can all agree that 72 is a really random number. I think most players agree something in the 100 to 120 range. is probably better. And my guess is going forward, they inch towards that. There's no reason just to lay this number out and say it's perfect. Because as you pointed out, they were also considering some sort of rule or regulation that would either make all cuts in the signature events or no cuts in the signature events. Because what you have right now is three of the eight have cuts and the others don't. It creates confusion among fans. It creates the confusion even among players. So I think those two things are married to each other. If you can get to a point where they're okay having cuts in all these events, then you would see an expansion in field size.
Having seen this play out in 2024, I'd be a fan of no cuts, but instead I would make sure that those players, the star players, are there for all four tournament rounds, but I would have a cut, quote unquote, essentially in the FedEx Cup points, where if you're finishing outside, let's say the top 50, you either get no FedEx Cup points or such a drastic reduction in points that you might as well have not even played those two rounds. I think that's a good compromise that, again, leans into the pro competitive aspect of the PGA Tour, while also ensuring that the sponsors are happy while having those marquee players make it to the weekend. At the tournament you're at, Rex, you probably are not staying much longer now that this has been a big fat nothing burger, but Rory McIlroy is not there announcing on Monday, about 12 hours after we completed our podcast, that he will not be playing the Travelers Championship again. Instead, we'll see him in a couple of weeks' time to defend his title at the Scottish Open ahead of the Open Championship at Royal Troon. I've been struck, Rex, in the last couple of days since the U.S. Open, this continued dialogue about his final hour collapse at Pinehurst. In particular, there has been a lot of discourse about the fact that Rory did not speak to the media. A lot of people think that was the wrong move. A lot of people want to give him a pass. Where do you sit on this debate?
You and I kind of talked about it a little bit on Sunday night after the final round. I understood it. Actually, the part that got me is my expectations were for him not to stop, because more times than not, after a bad round, he has gotten in the habit of not stopping. However, I did have to catch myself. Like, if I've been conditioned enough to not have the expectation that he would stop and talk, that's probably a bad thing for me and the bad thing for the media, because I don't think anybody was necessarily rushing up to the car as he sped away to make sure he had something to say. I am going to say that if you go back, and Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter on ESPN did a really good job pointing out that when Vandeveld blew up at the Open Championship, he spoke with the media. It was a magical press conference. I was there. It was something I'll never forget. When Phil Mickelson blew up at Wingfoot, he spoke with the media. I was there. It was a magical experience. I'm so stupid. Like, we all remember that moment. When Norman blew up at the Masters, he spoke with the media. There is an expectation, and this goes to, I think, what you and I have talked in the last couple of weeks. These are all equity partners now in this product. You are invested now in this product. And part of that investment means you have to talk to the media in good times or bad.
No, I think that's well put. In a vacuum, Rex, I tend to give Rory a pass on this one. This was a crippling defeat. You and I argued about this on Sunday night. I would argue it is quite clearly the most crushing defeat he has ever suffered. This was worse than the Masters in 2011. This was worse than the Open Championship in 2022, where we just couldn't get it going. This was worse than last year's U.S. Open, where he bogeyed the 14th and fell one shot shy. And so I understand. I understand that over the last hour, when you miss two putts inside 4 feet, like, the natural human instinct when you lose by one is to escape. And our job as reporters is to ask pointed questions and relay that to the sporting public, right? In this case, however, Rory's play, particularly over the final hour, and his emotions, there was a camera inside the scoring area, and Rory had his hands on his hips with his hat tilted back when Bryson DeChambeau made that putt. Like, his emotions said it all. And so in a vacuum, I give him a pass. Where you're exactly right on this is that this is not in a vacuum any longer, that these are professional athletes, and there is a professional responsibility to answer questions. Rory McIlroy made $2 million for finishing as the runner-up last week at the U.S. Open. There has to be some sort of accountability there. You bring up great examples, whether it's Vandeveld, whether it's Greg Norman, whether it's Phil Mickelson. I think back to Jordan Spieth in 2015 Masters. all of those players stood up and talked because they recognize that it is typically beneficial for them because it humanizes their failures. It provides context to what everyone had just witnessed. You're also right in that Rory has made a habit out of this. After being scapegoated by the PGA Tour for his role in this PGA Tour Live Divided, he's either dodged the media or put up certain rules or limited his time when talking to the media in this new environment where investor groups are trying to get a return on their investment. The players have to realize that there's more to it than just their 18-hole performance between the ropes. They have to be more front-facing. There has to be some accountability, and that is where I think Rory erred. If this was a one-off, certainly I think everyone would recognize from a human aspect, yeah, let's go ahead and give him a pass. We'll get a crack at him again in a couple weeks' time. I think the issue here, Rex, is more that he's made a habit out of this, and this sets a really bad precedent when we're getting into this new era.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And look, he could have taken as much time as he wants, as he wanted. If he wanted 30, 40 minutes to cool off, to stay inside the locker room, like we weren't going anywhere. Like I was writing Rory as a column. I was going to hang around. However, in this particular case, you're right. I think it's become more of a habit, which is the alarming part. It's not the one-off situation on Sunday at Pinehurst when everything didn't go his way and he imploded for, I think I'm coming around on you a little bit, probably the worst loss of his career. I'm coming around on that argument a little bit. It has to do more with not only is he not speaking with the media on a regular basis, and you're talking with someone who for the last probably 3 or 4 years has gotten to a heated debate with our colleague Doug Ferguson from the AP about voting Rory, the Golf Writers Association America. We call it the Bartlett Award, but it's essentially the media friendly award, for lack of a better term. And every year, like, there's reasons why. Either he's too young or maybe this, but in recent years it's had more to do with the idea that this has become the norm. And that's not what we want to recognize. It's not what we want to award.
I mean, I get it. He was clearly pissed afterward. He was clearly emotional afterward. He is not the first athlete who has dodged the media after a really disappointing and frustrating loss. I think Tom Brady in his last playoff game, he did not speak to the media afterward. You have basketball players who will put up a stinker in a decisive game seven and blow off the media afterward. Like that alone is not all that uncommon. The difference is that in those professional sports, those athletes have to be made available. There has to be some sort of media availability throughout the week, whether it's once, I think in the case of a quarterback, it has to be twice. Like there are certain rules and parameters. I don't think the PGA Tour, I know this is not a PGA Tour event, but I don't think the PGA Tour can get sort of into that same sort of pathway where they're forcing their players to talk, because there's 156 players in a field. Obviously, we do not need to talk to about 140 of them, but I do think as this U.S. investor group is interested in the experience that they have in the NFL, Major League Baseball, in the NBA, there is a professional responsibility, and they recognize that they need to have their athletes front-facing, front and center, at least a couple of times a week. I will be very curious to see if there's some sort of stipulation or regulation that's put in place over these next couple years that would require the top players to be more camera ready, shall we say, particularly in moments like this where it's so important to hear from them.
And let's be clear, I'm not the one here that wants to bang his fist, because that's a bad look and it's going to be a losing proposition, saying that you have to talk to the media after every single round of golf. I don't believe that, but there are going to be moments like Sunday at the U.S. Open when, yes, there is an expectation that I know it's hard. Again, take the time, take 30, 40 minutes, whatever it takes, but you're going to have to stand in front of the cameras, because the losing quarterback at the Super Bowl doesn't have the option of being like, no, not today. Don't want to do it. To your point, like other sports understand there is an importance of the athletes winning or losing, getting in front of the camera, telling their stories, because this is all part of the narrative that's going to sell the product. And they understand that. And I do want to like applaud, like kudos to you, man. Like normally you're not the best of teammates. Normally, you're really, really quick to throw me under the bus, and you carried the load for the last 10 minutes while this interview was going on. So kudos. Thank you very much. Like, that was good teammate stuff right there.
Michael Thorbjornsson, making his PGA Tour and professional debut this week, was number one in the PGA Tour University rankings after a decorated career at Stanford, in which he at one point was a top-ranked amateur in the world. Yeah. I believe he also has a top-five finish a couple years ago at the Travelers Championship. A lot of hype surrounding this kid. This was no disrespect to him whatsoever. I'm sure you did not know that he was coming to the media center at this very time. We are looking forward to seeing Michael Thorbjornsson this week at the Travelers Championship. Rex, one player who I think has recognized the necessity to be more front-facing in front of not just the media, but the fans as well, is our newly minted U.S. Open champion, Bryson DeChambeau. After we recorded the podcast, Bryson popped onto the live from set. He did an amazing segment with Johnson Wagner, in which Johnson Wagner, who has been befuddled and beguiled by the chipping yips, pulled off the 55-yard bunker shot, actually hit it to about a foot, actually got it closer than Bryson. It felt like one of those like season finales where you've been watching the show for a couple of months. You're hanging on every sort of episode. You're building this climax, and then the season finale is like everything you wanted to see. Like, that was such a great moment, and it made even better that Bryson was there on hand. But the very next morning, Bryson on the Today Show on Jimmy Fallon. He is now toting the U.S. Open trophy around at LIV Nashville, where he's teeing it up on Friday. What do you make of Bryson's world tour and what it means for the game at large?
Such interesting conversations on the range, really the last 2 days here at TPC. And I will say this, and I keep going back to the idea, like everyone wants to ask me, what did you make of Bryson's, not golf, we're not talking about his game, we're not talking about the way he won the U.S. Open. What did you make of his performance? And make no mistake, what he did during those rounds last week at Pinehouse, what he certainly did after the round when he's high-fiving fans and running around like a madman and taking sand out of the bunker and putting it in the trophy, all of that's performative. I have no doubt in my mind. He's enjoying himself. Like, that's what we want to see. We want to see personality, but this is performative. And sort of the question I was getting this morning from players, caddies, people who knew Bryson before he went to LIV Golf was, is he genuine? You know, is this something that you want to see? And I wrestled with a very similar conversation concept earlier in my career when Phil Mickelson would sign every single autograph. It didn't matter if he shot 78 or 68. And people would ask me, is that who he is? Is he genuine? And I wrestled with it for a couple of years and finally came to the notion that I don't care if he's genuine or not. He's good for the game.
It does not matter whether it's insincere, whether it's coming from a nefarious place.
Don't care.
It does not matter at all.
I don't care. And so what we saw on Sunday after the round, you're right, that the Johnson Wagner thing was the highlight of my week, because not only did he do it, well, it was the second shot. If we're going to be honest, that we have to fill in the gaps completely, but it was a really, really hard shot. He did it in the dark. I think he rocketed the first one into the clubhouse. Poor Pinehurst got a lot of those last week. However, like, that's just entertaining. It's what golf needs. And it goes back to the conversations that we just had about LIV and the PIF and the negotiations. I don't know that anything should spark and move the conversations along faster than what happened last week and what's going on this week, which is the most popular player on the planet right now. Forget about world rankings. Forget about who's going to be the player of the year. The most popular player on the planet right now is not playing in a signature event on the PGA Tour, playing in another event in another state on another network for another sponsor. That's a problem. And if anything's going to motivate the tour and the public investment fund to try to find some sort of bridge, it's got to be this.
Yeah, totally in agreement with you on that one, as well as the point that, and I, as I wrote on Sunday night for NBCSports.com/golf, Bryson is essentially Phil Mickelson without all of the vices. Who cares if it's performative? Who cares if he's an actor? Who cares if he is clearly and keenly aware of where the grandstands are, where the cameras are? Like, he is like purposely seeking out the camera and then having some sort of reaction. I think it's working. I absolutely think it's working. This is a clinic to me, again, regardless of what the intentions are, this is a clinic on how a golfer, a professional golfer, a PGA Tour or LIV golfer needs to act in the year 2024 with all of this new, this new era upon us. This is fan engagement 101, and he has been an absolute master. I think it's obvious that the years of training that he has put into YouTube and becoming sort of this singular personality and this outsized personality is now paying off in a big way now that he is competitive in the most high profile, biggest tournaments. I think it is almost completely changed the public perception of Bryson DeChambeau. Keep in mind, 2 or 3 years ago, he was vilified, he was jeered, he was booed, he was feuding with tour leadership, he was unpopular among his peers, he was boycotting the media, and now, as I wrote on Sunday, like, he's the people's champ. He was, if not as popular as Rory McIlroy, even slightly more popular than Rory. Again, we did not get the head-to-head comparison. It is still apples to oranges, but it was obvious that Bryson was a highly popular player at Pinehurst, and it's gotten to a point, unimaginably, that fans want to see him more than four times a year. I think back to Valhalla, the PGA Championship, where he shot 20 under par, pushed Xander Schauffele all the way to the end. Fans were disappointed, and it was a realization that we're only going to get two more doses of Bryson at this sort of stage, and that's a great point, Rex. Like, that's a huge problem. This has identified a huge problem in the current golf landscape.
And we just got through having a whole conversation on why Rory blowing off the media on Sunday was bad, and it's because you are a partner now. You're part of the equity plan. You need to be part of the product, not part of the problem. I should coin that. That's pretty good. Because what Bryson did is, you're right, it's 101. It's what all of them should be doing. It's not in many of their DNAs, but a version of that needs to be. We actually had a colleague, one of our colleagues, come up to me this morning and throw the hypothetical out there that let's say that Bryson wins the Open Championship in a few weeks. So that will give him a runner-up, two wins in a major championship, and I believe he finished eighth at the Masters. Where does the voting for Player of the Year for the GWAA, which isn't based on membership, it's based on performance, where does that land? In my mind, I'm still voting for Scotty because I feel like what Scotty did is more consistent, but maybe that's just because it's forefront on your mind because you're seeing him week in and week out. Well, you're not seeing Bryson week in and week out.
Bryson didn't and can't play in the Players' Championship. Bryson didn't and can't play in the President's Cup. Bryson didn't. And it won't because of
the
OWGR math play in the Olympic tournament as well. In addition, of course, to the FedEx Cup playoffs. Like it's just an incomplete resume. That being said, I did vote for Cam Smith in 2022 as the player of the year that year, not just factoring in his Players Championship and his Open title, but as well as a couple of wins on LIV Golf that year. It has been highly impressive. Again, if Bryson can pull this off and contend the Open Championship, where he never has in his career, I think the entire reinvention would certainly be complete. I know this has been a big nothing burger for you in terms of news this week, and I can't wait to see you during the 3M, during 3M week, maybe the John Deere Classic pounding the pavement.
Why are you doing that to me? Why are you wishing that on me?
We have the Players, the Travelers Championship this week, which you will not be sticking around for, at TPC River Highlands, which I do think is always a great view, especially on that back nine. The big storylines this week, Rex. How will Scottie Scheffler rebound after T41? Xander Schauffele, back-to-back top 10s after his first major championship at the PGA Championship. Patrick Cantlay coming off the best major finish of his career. And Ludvig Åberg and Colin Morikawa looking to finally knock off that win in 2024. Even though you're not going to see it in person, if you're watching it at home on TV, what are you most looking forward to seeing this week?
Scotty. I think both of us were pretty shocked by Scotty's performance last week. And for whatever reason, you know, I think we've covered what he felt like went wrong, what we felt like from the outside went wrong. He's back now at a golf course where clearly there should be some sort of comfort level. He's back now in some sort of routine that should be the comfort level. Can he pick up? I 100% think he will, but you always want to sit back and you want to watch. Is he going to pick up where he left off before Pinehurst, before really Valhalla, if we want to make the argument? Because you don't know, like, all of this is cumulative. Like, what happened to Valhalla and getting arrested, trying to put yourself into contention, now moving forward to the Memorial where he clearly got beat up, and then to Pinehurst where he just looked, I'm going to say, befuddled, for lack of a better term, which we haven't seen out of him and during this dominant run. He always looks like he's in control. He always looks like he knows exactly what's coming next, and that wasn't the case next week. Does he shrug that off this week? I expect him to, but we'll see.
It was a little bit validating to hear Scotty say on Wednesday in his press conference that the sandy native areas at Pinehurst number two did play mind games, as you and I both thought it could have. The unpredictability. Scotty Scheffler has dominated traditional PGA Tour venues and setups so far this year. The randomness, the chance, the bad lies, the good lies that players would find in those sandy waste areas, that was clearly playing in the minds of Scotty Scheffler and why he had one of the poorest driving performances of his entire year last week at the U.S. Open. I'm with you, and you actually bring up a good point about, you know, does Bryson nab the GWA Player of the Year award? I think there's still some potential, as crazy as it sounds on June 19th, that Xander Schauffele could eventually become the PGA Tour Player of the Year. I know it sounds ludicrous to throw that out there on June 19th, considering he has just a single victory so far this season. But you look at his performance in the Players' Championship, you look at his performance in other signature events. There is still this final signature event to be played, as well as the Open Championship, where he has fared well in the past, as well as the FedEx Cup playoffs. He is always a good bet to win at Eastlake, site of the Tour Championship.
And of course, Olympics.
The Olympic tournament, the defending champion there and gold medal winner in Tokyo just a couple of years ago. I still think there is a potential, as crazy as it sounds, that Xander Schauffele could get PGA Tour Player of the Year over Scotty Scheffler, but it all starts this week at the Travelers Championship for this final push for the FedEx Cup. Rex, you'll be heading home either Wednesday night or Thursday morning. What's on the docket for the rest of the week before we reconvene on Sunday for the Travelers Championship and Live Nashville recaps?
My lawn is dead, so much like you did the last 2 days, I'm going to spend the next few days trying to bring it back to life because in Florida has been hot and no water, so that's probably first and foremost. And then I need to cook. You sent me a Snapchat last night that hurt me to my core. It looked delicious. I'm tired of eating hotel food. I'm tired of waking up to a buffet breakfast, so I need to. I think whatever you looked like you did a ribeye last night and it looked like it was delicious.
Yes, it was my 5.5-year-old's half birthday. Apparently, those are things that we have to celebrate half birthdays. He wanted a ribeye and he wanted a cake, which most certainly sounds like a Lavner. I'm with you. There's been an irrigation crisis here in Ponte Vedra, so I did have to do some lawn care. It's called like Milagronite or something. In any case, it smells because it is like cow manure. So I sprinkled that down. Apparently, in 2 or 3 weeks, it's supposed to blossom. Who knows? If not, my hands are just going to smell for no particularly good reason. Also want to point out why I'm wearing these ridiculous looking headphones on this podcast record. If you're following along on YouTube, I'm currently feuding with the Spring Hill Suites, which may have maliciously and intentionally swiped my AirPods off my bed and are now trying to charge me $75 to ship them back. I will make a stand. I will not stand for this. And so I will fight this tooth and nail over the 30 days that I have remaining before they eventually throw them in the dumpster or sell them on eBay because that is what they seem convinced to do. I will fight this and let you know a week from now whether I have made any progress.
That's the hill you want to die on. Mm-hmm. This is where the line you want to draw on the sand. Yeah,
that's
headphones.
Company
issued headphones that you got for free. You didn't pay for them.
I paid for these years ago, and right. I certainly could get a new set of new pair for like $90, but no, at this point.
How about I give you mine? You take mine and you stop this ridiculous crusade.
Fine. I'll take it. Hopefully we do have more news next Wednesday if I've made any progress on that front. You'll know because I'll still be wearing these ridiculous headphones if not. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys are the drill. NBCSports.com/golf. We thought we'd have more updates on the tour PIF drama. Instead, you can just read Rex's sad 5-paragraph blog that is currently up on the website, but we'll also be charting
quick last night.
The Travelers Championship,
posted it quick.
Live Nashville, as well as the Women's KPMG Championship, which is being played this week in Sahali. All that and more coming up on Sunday. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you guys.